those lows and highs are going to continue to be extreme. They're going to get worse. They're going to build on each other. Each event fuels the next event is the problem.
Welcome to The Flux Capacitor, a podcast about the future of electricity. I'm Francis Bradley of Electricity Canada. This is number 106, episode 106 of The Flux Capacitor. I've chatted with the industry's business leaders, thought leaders, new market players and stakeholders, the folks that have been pondering the future of how we create, move, trade and use energy, and what the future changes will mean for electricity companies, regulators, society and customers. I hope these conversations have given you, the listener, a sense of the conversations that are taking place in the sector, on coffee breaks, at industry conferences, on the margins of regulatory hearings, or over a drink following a parliamentary committee appearance. This episode of the pod is a deep dive into weather. My guest on the podcast today is
Sunny Westcott, Chief Meteorologist in the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Division of Homeland Security.
Sunny joined me for a conversation about extreme weather, the impacts on infrastructure, the cyclical worsening of events, and the challenges of stabilizing the climate. We also talk about what customers should be thinking about in emergencies and opportunities for creative solutions. We close the conversation with Sunny's on-brand recommendation for a book to add to the Flux Capacitor Book Club. Here is my conversation with Sunny Westcott, recorded on Zoom in early January 2025. Sunny, welcome to the podcast. I asked you in the fall to come on the podcast, and I'm glad that we were finally able to schedule it. You were able to squeeze some time in between various storms that are going on.
Yeah, there's quite a few different storm systems across the U.S. winter weather-wise that are highly destructive as it's turning out. We have fire weather down in the southwest and, of course, drought lingering in those areas. Yeah. So no matter where you are in the U.S., there's some new flavor of extreme weather event going on this year.
Yeah, well, I was complaining like a moment ago just before I hit record that I don't have enough snow to build snow shelters and the skiing is terrible. There's been snow south of me. There's been snow north of me, but no snow at all. But there has been no shortage, right? You were saying that avalanches are a real issue right across the globe right now.
Yeah, we have avalanches going on across the Northern Rockies where we've seen a significant dumping of snow in the early onset of the year. The Rocky Mountains, having gone through a drought most recently and lost a lot of their vegetation, the snowpack is unstable because it's coming in too quick. And then we've also seen an increase in avalanche activity across France, over in the Alps. We've seen records as far as the amount of snow that's moving in these snow slips, and then the amount that's coming down on the back end of an avalanche, which is amplifying the threat throughout the season.
Yeah, so I mean, it sounds as though, at least you know, in one of those instances, clearly it is the compounding issues of subsequent events. You said that the part of the problem is the lack of vegetation because things had been dry, and now things are wet in terms of snow, and so one is compounding the other.
Yeah, so when you lose a lot of the vegetation and a lot of that tree cover, what that allows is for the solar radiation throughout the year to kind of permeate a lot deeper into your groves, into your forests. Yeah. And that kind of slowly begins to kill off a lot of the other plants. We have insect movements that are going on because of the drought, the fires. When we have a fire that breaches higher into the elevations, we get a certain particular type of insect that makes its way in that really starts to kind of feed on a lot of the live material that's left over, and that can create compounding issues. So when you do see your first snowpack, the ground is abnormally warm, the trees aren't there to shade it so it doesn't stay as long, and they're in by the next direct solar radiation period. Yeah. It all starts to melt off a lot faster, and then it'll pull snow with it as it melts off, which will create that compounding issue of runoff, and then that runs right into the river system at greater rates, filling the river from the bottom up with topsoil. And that reduces our river's capabilities to hold the snowpack runoff. So we actually see these cyclical worsening events from the onset of the abnormal warming during the summer going all the way through the winter period. And that's really compounding what we're going to be seeing this spring with wildfires. Too much precip at once allows for spring up of vegetation. Mm-hmm. That dies off really quick because it's very weak. And then that fuels the wildfire season. And without the trees to block the wind, you have stronger winds coming through. So you can see how each trigger triggers the next one.
Right. Yeah. So when we were at the GridSec conference in the fall, I had the pleasure of moderating a panel to which you were on. And one of the things that I asked you about was, you know, what's the sort of the next term that's going to be part of the popular lexicon? It seems as though each season of extreme weather brings another term that we add to the lexicon, whether it's atmospheric rivers or derechos or bomb cyclones. I know these are certainly terms that you and your colleagues that are meteorologists use all the time, but it seems as though the subsequent extreme weather seasons are, you know, each time we get another one, we get a new term that we're going to be adding to the popular lexicon. And so, like, what are the next sort of terms that we need to know about that we will be using to describe extreme weather in the next couple of seasons?
Yeah, so I've done a big push within different meteorological communities to pull off of hurricanes as the terminology, because now we're starting to see that tropical storms and depressions, tropical waves can be far more destructive in the amount of rain that's coming down. So our hurricane labeling is based solely off of winds. So I've moved to tropical cyclones and all of our documentation across CISA. I've really pushed across DHS to say tropical cyclone, because that does encapsulate all of it. Okay. It encapsulates what happened with Sandy, where it became a superstorm. We also have other products that are coming out soon, like the lightning protection guide, which is going to talk a lot about some of the myths and some of the concepts of lightning. And we use the term convective, and that's annotating that it's a thunderstorm. Yep. A lot of people think that thunderstorms can be any cloud system, when really lightning only comes from one cloud, and that's the cumulonimbus or the CB. So when we talk about different storm events, it slowly bleeds into general society, each of the different terminology that we utilize to make it make sense for aviation, for emergency managers, for all of the different operations that we do. And then as it gets into the general society, it helps them to be able to do their own research to learn more, like about frost quakes. Mm-hmm. Frost quakes may sound new. They're not new. They are rare because it's usually a lot more dense of a snowpack, a lot more dense of icing throughout like the Great Lakes region. So they don't see frost quakes often, but now with uneven distribution of heating and the dense dropping of snow and ice, it's likely they'll see frost quakes more, and you'll see it permeate the news. And then they'll say, oh, this is a new weather event. Yep. And you can say, no, we've had frost quakes. It's just now it's coming into your eye because it's happening so much more often. Same thing with fire tornadoes. Mm-hmm. You know, we know that those can happen. We know that the pyrocumulus cloud, while again, it used to be quite rare for our developed societies to see those way back at the beginning of the earth, whenever you have these large fires that can kick off, they have the capability of creating a pyrocumulus cloud. So mm-hmm. they're not new, but they're definitely being seen more often. They're permeating into our built infrastructure, into our areas. And then, of course, the prevalence of the camera allows for us to see this and talk about it in real time, which is new as of the last, you know, 20 years.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so there's a couple of the terms that you used I didn't want to drill down on. First, Sandy, and Sandy was a superstorm. So is a superstorm an actual term that meteorologists use, or was it something that was just invented by CNN because it gave good headlines?
It is a term that was kind of adopted because, much like bomb cyclone was utilized by a meteorologist originally, it was sort of to emphasize cyclogenesis, which is the longer term of what that is. So when you kind of shortchange, so you don't want to say, oh, it's a post-tropical system, which means it's a tropical system that merged in with a frontal boundary, which then took on continental and oceanic attributes and then slammed both into, you know, our northeast. So it doesn't roll off the tongue. So if you say superstorm, it's not quite a hurricane, it's not quite a continental system, but it is a post-tropical event because it was tropical and then took on dry air intrusion, became open facing like a comma cloud. So there's explanation you can give. And there is a meteorological term, but it does make it a little bit easier for people to digest. Like, we don't name our winter storms,
right?
But the Weather Channel names them. And so subsequently, a lot of people, it helps them to affiliate, you know, the deep freeze of 2021 or winter storm Uri. And gotcha. Is Uri recognized, you know, internationally? No, because it's a continental low and we don't name those. But yes, we do need to create that sort of shared vernacular for that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Well, then the other one is, you mentioned frostquakes. So what is a frostquake? Or is it something that Canadians just refer to as Tuesday? I don't know. What is a frostquake?
It's likely that some areas see it so often that they already know to attribute it. Like, we know that Japan sees a ton of earthquakes and therein by small ones may go unnoticed because they are very used to it, whereas newcomers into the area would be more frightened. Frostquake is essentially, you get this dense packing of snow and ice through the region, which permeates into the ground. So now the ground is nice and frozen, much like the permafrost is. However, because it's not permafrost, it's not left in a perma region, it's not in the Arctic. So what ends up happening is it starts to thaw out at variable rates. So if the sunlight gets in and the ground warms, or the middle part, you know, starts to warm and then it snows or ices again on top, you end up with this uneven distribution of precipitation and the different densities. And what ends up happening is they fold in on each other, create a sort of strike slip on their own ice shelf that's inside of this, you know, contained event. Hmm. And the quake ends up occurring as like a break apart of the frozen precipitation, which feels like an earthquake for those who are around that material, because it does echo kind of across that precipitation field. So you can feel what is seemingly an earthquake, but it is very shallow because it's essentially everything that's fallen on the earth interacting with the surface of the earth at different densities. So it's like a mini quake that's only applicable to the frozen precipitation.
Okay, gotcha. All right, so let's talk about changing weather and what the data basically is telling you, because that's one of the things that I've been struck by in your presentations, is that like every slide you put up when you're doing your presentations has all of the references in terms of where you're drawing all of your data from. And so like there's no doubt about the sort of the veracity of the basis for the material that you're putting forward. So for the listener, like, what is happening? You know, climate change, our climate is changing. How would you characterize that change, you know, if you needed to summarize it?
Yeah, so a lot of people think, oh, it's this uneven distribution of heating that's the main mechanism of change, which causes all of these cascading effects. So then when you have these freeze events, their response is always, well, if it's warming that's causing the problem, why is it happening during the cold?
Right.
So you have to be able to explain that it's the heating that causes a sort of wobble in the stability of our weather events. So what that is it's the low pressures. You have to follow the symptoms to the base cause and then find what's triggering that. So a lot of people annotate the symptoms are these weather hazards, you know, the tropical cyclones, the sea level rise, extreme heat, extreme cold, drought, wildfires, all of these things at the surface that they're experiencing are coming from a change in the barometric low. And that low controls everything we know on the surface. You know, the lows move the high pressures, so the heat domes, stagnant air events, those clear, beautiful picnic skies. Those are all driven away by these low pressures, which are our big storms. Tropical cyclones are also lows. You know, all of our cyclonic activity are these depths within the atmosphere. So it's kind of a push down in the atmosphere that's changing. It's getting deeper, slower moving, more powerful.
Right.
That's what the uneven distribution of heat is feeding into. And we know that the higher rates of evaporation from heating during the summer, during the spring, you know, during that time period, all of that moisture gets lifted into the atmosphere to kind of fuel these severe weather outbreaks on the leading end of these lows. But these lows are the parent problem. Mm-hmm. So as the low changes, as it changes in pattern, intensity, prevalence, all of that is problematic for everyone across the entirety of that jet stream. So for us, the Northern Hemisphere, it's us, it's Europe, it's Northern Africa, it's Russia, China, all of those areas within that belt are going to see, like right now, we have record-breaking warmth in Arizona. Mm-hmm. Everywhere else right now is significantly colder than usual. We have this giant winter storm. So when they say it's colder, I can always point to another area where there's abnormal activity going on that's kind of helping drive the push of warmth further up, which subsequently yields a bigger drop on the back end, just like horses on a carousel. It's the exact same concept. They're all going one direction. There's north-south variation. If you mess with the intensity of the carousel, you're on a far more hazardous ride.
Okay. So the horses on, and I've heard you use that analogy before. So the horses on the carousel are basically going around the northern hemisphere, and
Yes.
they're going higher and they're going lower than they've ever gone before.
They're packing bigger of a punch. So even if they stay on a similar path, it's that they're not transitioning outside of that north south. So the up downs aren't going into that nice stagnant pattern. The area where you have like a bench in between the horses on a carousel and everyone's just sitting there kind of coasting across, not riding the horse. We've lost a lot of those. So we're losing the sort of zonal pattern, that blanket of storms coming across the mid latitudes. And now they're having that north-south variation a lot more frequently. And then because of that, it's causing a lot more moisture to move down. It's causing a lot more heating to move up. You can see that sort of variation. And that's the problem. We've seen it before historically. Whenever anybody says, we've had record-breaking floods, record-breaking heat, you know, way back in the medieval era. And the response is, our built infrastructure wasn't around back in the medieval era. We didn't have the populations we have now. We didn't have the food industry we have now. We haven't taken out the trees we've taken out now. You know, we've changed a lot. And it's important to understand that even if way back in, you know, the dinosaur era, it was hotter or something, that's a different period than what we want to live in, that we can sustain in, because we've changed so much.
We're not living atop of grass and forest. We're living atop cement and concrete. So even that has an impact, doesn't it?
Yep, absolutely. The concrete has a safety level that it likes to operate within, and then it sits with other materials, steel, wood. You have all these intermixes with it. So as they interact with each other, some of them like hotter temperatures, some of them like colder temperatures. Most of them don't like when water gets in between them. So as you see greater rates of flooding, greater rates of heating and freezing, these materials buck against each other. They break, they crack, they dimple, and they warp. And then everything that sits atop them just gets to play with whatever's left over. And that creates a massive issue for being able to sustain our built infrastructure in the cities, our roadways, our railways, our runways, everything that we need for the supply chain that we need for our day-to-day operations, transportation to and from work. A lot of this, like what we've gotten used to over the last 70 years, wasn't built to be here 70 years later, even at the conditions they built it at, let alone at worsening weather event conditions. So if we have a heat wave that's similar to the 1700s in prevalence and intensity, we didn't build anything now under the standards of the 1700s. We built it under the standards of the mid-1900s, which were far more comfortable weather events on the regular. It was a more persisting stability than it is now.
So what is the what does this data tell you in terms of the trend? The horses on the carousel are moving higher and lower, up and down. They're moving faster. What does that tell you about where these trends are going to go?
So that's an unfortunate. So we just created through going back through every automated sensor that we could get our hands on data-wise across the US. So that's all empirical data that nobody's gotten to play with. You know, sensors are automated. We put in a lot after World War II. So we have all of this information that's raw available at the surface, recording every hour, days and days and days. Even if one sensor goes down, there are just so many sensors at this point that at least we have backup. So we're able to run that sensor data against a script of coding. That goes through and reviews the barometric lows. So that's your mean sea level pressure in some areas. For some of them, it's the altimeter setting for those who are, you know, aviation inclined. So when you look at those, you're able to see that from the 1970s, I know we see a lot of graphs that talk about the 1970s, our third industrial revolution. The 1970s onward, you start to see that the lows started to take on greater swings, low, high, low, high. And these intensities not only got closer together, but the extremes started to patter out further and further to the ends of the chart. Now, that's not to say that some years didn't have stability. That's to say that the trend is getting to that point of extreme, and it's getting there rapidly. Now, the problem with that is there's no way to slow that down at this point. Unfortunately, when you create a wobble, like a butterfly effect or a ripple in the pool, you will see that ripple continue towards the end. You will see the wobble continue until it's able to stabilize because you've stopped wobbling it, but it will take, you know, time to get back to stability. So when a lot of people ask me, well, if we stop emitting right now, if we stop this, if we stop that, if we move away from concrete, if we return the earth to green right today, and we were able to just do that in a flash, you know, as somebody as a genie, would we be good from here onward? And the answer is no. Once you create the wobble, you have the wobble for a permeating period of time. Do we have exactly how much time that takes? No. Are we going to get every country to stop emitting at the rate to get to neutral by 2030? Even if we get to neutral by 2030, the 30s into the 40s are definitely going to be extreme weather. When we're looking at erosion on the coastlines, we've lost a lot of the coastline in some areas. Some of our island nations are seeing higher and higher waves. That's problematic for their sustainability. We're looking at our ports, which were built quite a while ago. Our dams were built almost 80 years ago in some areas. When you're looking at these weather events against the built infrastructure, if I'm saying for the next 15 years at minimum, those lows and highs are going to continue to be extreme. They're going to get worse. They're going to build on each other. Each event fuels the next event is the problem. And they fuel this cyclical, you know, ecology shift. What does it look like to operate in that? And the response everyone comes back with, well, you know, it breaks, so we go in and we rebuild. Why aren't you changing what you built? Because you just showcased it can break. So even if it lasted 50 years, it's not going to last another 50 years now in extreme weather events. We should be looking at, okay, well, we saw winds at 110 miles per hour and 6 inches of rain and the building failed. So you need to build a building that can withstand more than 115 miles per hour and more than 6 inches of rain, not the same building and just hope that you don't see that event again for a good bit. You know, that's a big part of the communication with the private sector, that not every answer is on the table right now. Some of it requires going back to S&T, to your research and development departments, and having them come to the table and figure out new materials, new shapes, new designs. Where are we building? Are we building into nature or against nature and playing that game of paying the price later?
Right. So even if we do begin addressing emissions, we're still facing probably a generation or two of the wobble continuing.
Absolutely. So I have a 11-year-old and him and I have these wonderful conversations about this where I get to be like, hey, I didn't trigger this. And in all fairness, it was generations of development that benefited us. The roads, the bridges, the homes. You know, my home was built in the 70s. Was it built to withstand what's coming? No. Did they know? Would I have known? No. Well, a lot of this data is new as of now. So there's a lot of finger pointing and blaming that goes on, but not all the data was consolidated. It's really about once you learn, being able to back up, pivot and change. Being able to invest, you know, in the right directions or make moves in the right directions. And a lot of times that conversation can come off as hostile because it does sound like blaming. When you talk to the farming community and you say there's not enough water to grow the same types of crops the same way you've been doing it, we need to change. And they say, we need the water or you don't get to eat. And we have to go through this sort of, how do we communicate the change to industry and get industry to come back to us and say, we found a solution for our sector, and then we can see if it fits other sectors and move in tandem, because that's really the only way is to build resilient while also reducing emissions. It's a sort of twofold, because you don't want the tidal wave to continue to get bigger or more tidal waves on the back end. You want to be able to survive the tidal wave you're riding. And that's really a big part of it, is getting everybody to learn how to kind of tread water until it's done.
Right. Okay. Well, listen, one of the things I ask everybody that comes on the podcast is about their journey. And I always make the joke, when you were a little kid on the playground, did you always dream of becoming the chief meteorologist at CISA DHS? What was your journey?
So I got made fun of a lot, actually, for my name. So my first name is Sunny, S-U-N-N-Y. So a lot of people just assume nowadays that I changed it for my job, or I was always destined to do weather. So there were so many comments about it. My middle name was Rose. So I sounded like a hippie. Like everywhere I went, oh, Sunny Rose. And I was like, ah, well, it's weird because I went in the military. So it's actually really aggressive. As a child, I was really combative. I was highly argumentative. I was factually based, so everything that I could find that had evidence, I just really liked to argue with people. So I got into speech and debate. I was like president of my German club. I just really enjoyed like the engagement. I'm really social. So I was always told I was going to be a lawyer growing up. That was a big thing. It was, Sunny's going to grow up and she's going to take over the world, or she's going to become a CEO, because I'm just really engaging and intense. But I found out in order to be a lawyer, you usually have to start lower on the totem pole. You have to kind of, you know, work your way up sort of in a way. I didn't really want to. I'm definitely not a people person in that way. When I went in the military, found out that, you know, I didn't even pick weather. My dad picked weather out of the jobs. I asked for the top five hardest tech schools, shuffled them upside down, picked three at random, gave them to my dad. And I was like, pick one. He picked weather. because my name was Sunny, and he was like, oh, the odds are you're going to end up on like TV or something and you won't deploy. So he did it out of a want to keep me safe. And I was just like, I'll learn anything. So I took over weather. I was top forecaster. I completed my career development courses really early. I strove for like various awards on the base. I'm just very intense. And weather just kind of, as I learned more about it, there was just so much to keep pulling in. And now I can use it everywhere I go as a conversation piece, which helps me. You know, I can go to a bar and talk to someone who says, oh, the weather's acting crazy. And I can be like, do you want to know why? So I get to benefit society. They benefit me because I learn how to speak to everybody about weather. So the more I engage, the more I learn. And I love learning. So that's my journey is a little weirder than I think normal people, because I had no intention of going weather, despite my name.
Yeah. And then, so it was military, it was Air Force?
It was.
Okay. And then how did you get from the Air Force to DHS?
So a lot of people, when they get out of the military, they kind of buck against their career field, especially weather. We get burnt out very quickly because you work with pilots a lot. You get yelled at a lot. You know, you're responsible for tornado
watches,
lightning, everything. Everything that goes wrong on a flight line, they yell at the weather people. If you put out lightning within five, they yell at you because they want to fly and you have to explain risk. And it's a lot for anyone, you know, between the ages of 18 to 25 to be dealing with life and death situations like that and making those decisions. That was, you know, that's a high intense thing. So I got out and, you know, I did a bunch of like odd end research. I wanted to get into something else, but I really enjoyed catastrophic things. Mm-hmm. So I was going into biological warfare as a study because weather plays into bioweapons.
Yep.
So I started looking for things of weapons of mass destruction, different ways to engage with the public and use my experience of atmospheric knowledge. And I found Homeland Security because obviously they would have the weapons of mass destruction courses.
Yep.
And through that, I found public safety was a lot more fun and engaging, getting to talk to general emergency managers, work with police, work with firefighters, the hospitals. You know, they're all very engaging as a community for information and assistance from the federal government. So when I started as a watch floor analyst. And then kind of made my way up to a leader role within that, just a standard team lead. But I was augmented because they found out I was weather after they hired me. And they saw that, you know, all of my work ability, the thing that impacts our infrastructure the most is weather. It happens constantly and it's getting worse.
Yeah.
So I started to get pulled aside into these separate roles. So I worked in telecommunications for a bit. I worked in geospatial for a bit. This role was sort of really created around my knowledge base, and we're really starting to robustly flesh it out. And then, you know, as time goes on and we start to move in the right directions for infrastructure, move in the right directions with cyber and move in tandem with other agencies, there's going to be a lot more in the weather side of the house, being able to get infrastructure owners and operators to understand the changes, understand the events, the damage margins, and then get those to work together versus the stove piping that's been done over the last couple of decades.
Okay. So let's talk about you know, kind of getting back to the challenges that these weather events are bringing forth: extreme heat, extreme cold, the high winds and so on, specifically with respect to electricity. And you know, what are the sorts of things that we should be thinking about as the wobble continues, and as it gets more extreme? What do we need to be thinking about with respect to generating electricity, transmitting electricity, and then also talk a little bit about you know, what customers should be thinking about? But why don't we start at the upstream generation, you know, implications certainly for hydro generation. And you talked a little bit about that. And we've certainly seen that the last couple of years, certainly here in Canada, where, you know, 60% of our electricity generation is coming from hydro. And we've had some lean years. It sounds as though what you're saying is those lean years are going to be part of this wobble and may even be more significant as we move forward.
Yeah, there's a sort of twofold that comes in whenever I talk to anybody in the energy sector or any of our critical infrastructure who rely on energy, which is essentially everybody. when we're talking about choices, a lot of people want to dump all their eggs in one basket when it comes to energy. They just want a quick solution. They want a fix. They want something they can count on perpetually with no fluctuations, no variations, no damage margins. And that doesn't exist. It's a diversifying the portfolio that really brings in that stability. So hydro is a great concept if we were able to stabilize it. And when I'm saying that, you know, our water cycle is going to get more extreme, it's very hard to count on hydro in an extreme. It's hard to count on anything in an extreme. Our solar panels are dark and they create a localized heat sink, which fuels hail events. So we're seeing more hail damage to the solar panels, and we see it with asphalt roofs. We see it with our dark roadways. We see it with the urban infrastructure. Hail events are getting worse and they're taking more damage with them. Subsidence from where our pipelines are put in. Those are sinking down at varying rates. That's damaging the pipeline. It's causing more leaks and spills. We're seeing the wind turbines getting struck by lightning, taken out by these tornadoes that are pushing further to the north. Lightning strikes are increasing because the heating is increasing and the instability is. We're seeing a hit to every sector type. These major transmission lines that run for miles and miles and miles in some areas for multiple states, if you have one storm go through and take out a segment and that ends up crippling an entire region, that can be incredibly problematic to restore. And if we look at where our oldest transmission lines are, and we know that that whole area needs to be scraped and rebuilt, and we don't want to have to do it just yet, then we're going to see what happened with Helene in North Carolina, where the flooding, the mudslides, and the tornado took out enough of the infrastructure that the whole area needed to be rebuilt, which rapidly increased the amount of time that it was going to take to rebuild and put energy back into that area. So a lot of people say, well, if gas is so bad, if fracking is so bad, and it does cause earthquakes, and we know this, fracking equals earthquakes in many areas because it is changing the amount of moisture under the earth. So the oil industry has its own flaws, solar has its own flaws, hydro has flaws, wind turbines has flaws. We look at all of these, not any single one of them should be a dump eggs in all basket kind of a thing, all eggs in one basket. So when we look at EVs, for example, and we look at gas powered cars, a lot of people want to jump straight into EVs and they say EVs are the way of the future. But lithium comes with its own price tag. It comes with its own problem set. What are we doing with those batteries after, you know, they've run completely dry and they can't take a charge anymore? What are we doing with the lithium ion mines when we're pulling lithium to make lithium ion batteries? Those mines, you know, that does damage to the environment as well. So we're looking at each one of these. It's really taking a fraction of each and creating a sort of microgrid system of an interconnect of a multitude. So when I talk to hydro people, the response is, well, we know the atmosphere is getting more hostile. It's sucking out more moisture from the surface. It's overheating the river system, killing off the fish, the ecology. And my response was, we should cover the water so that it's not evaporating out as fast. And their response is, how are we going to boat on the water if we cover the water? And I'm like, well, you can't have both in the future. You can't have boating and that's not a thing. You can't have a lake with a boat on it. If you want the lake to survive the heat wave, you know, you need to cover it. What does that look like going forward to still have recreation and our water system operations? A lot of big moves have been to pumped hydro storage underground, utilizing things like our leftover abandoned coal mines. You know, we've already dug those out and those are sinking in, as we saw with New Jersey. We see coal mine fires where the coal seam combusts in direct sunlight. So a lot of people are like, we should go back to coal. Coal combusts naturally, and that's a problem because it triggers wildfires and it can ignite the coal mine, causing the coal mine to collapse in. So if we were to utilize the coal mines in a pumped hydro storage, you know, concept, which we're trying in Kentucky right now, and I believe the UK's already done, we also have these other capabilities to learn from other countries. Like Canada's got offshore tidal energy, as does parts of the UK. And here in the US, some of the conversation was that doesn't produce enough to warrant building it. But we don't want an end-all, be-all solution because then it's too big and will fail. So we're looking at, you know, how do we make these smaller moves more viable, more incentivized? Because tidal energy could help break up the waves coming into the coastline as well. So there's caveats with each one. You know, if we were to do solar panels right, we could create shading, much like we say we need from trees. You know, solar panels can provide that. Wind turbines can be offshore. But what does it look like, you know, with an 80-foot wave and a wind farm offshore? You know, these problems are huge and they require having a discussion without an ego.
Do you see that happening?
I have hopes. It's not imminent. I would say it's probably not going to happen in the next couple of years, but I'm hopeful that when we start to see the disasters, and that's always what someone asks at the end of a presentation, they're like, what good news do you have? And I'm like, oh, well, disaster drives innovation. enough damage has to be done for you to set aside your ego for the want of the answer.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, I do think it's on the horizon because I think enough damage is on the horizon.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and the other thing, I mean, you talked about electricity generation, you talked about transmission. You know, what should the customer be thinking of when sort of projecting out into the future? Should the customer be thinking in terms of perhaps not absolutely relying on that assured supply and be thinking of redundancy in their own lives? Or
yeah, that's been a hard push. You know, originally the advocation was to be good for 2 days, then it was 3 days, then it was a couple of days and like this vague notion. But really what we're leaning forward on going forward is you need to be good for about 2 weeks. That's problematic for everybody. Nobody right now across the US, if you were to go knock on someone's door, you know, hey, if I shut off power and water to your house, are you good for 2 weeks? The response would be no. And that's a problem set. They don't have backup generation. And even if we did, if you store your backup generator outside of the house and the heat wave comes, you know, you're risking a combustion event or you're risking degraded materials outside, depending on the generator.
Yeah.
So like our propane tanks are at risk right now because 122 plus degrees and they can combust as well. The material can cause a vapor leak and all of these problems. So when we're looking at being isolated, being able to be off the grid just for a bit while the grid gets back together, The microgrid concept, as well as with water, you know, these micro concepts of community hubs of resilience, they're definitely possible to do. Moving to solar on rooftops, you know, a lot of people say, well, you know, it's not viable, or they're really heavy, or they come with all these other, and they can amplify heat events, they can amplify localized heating. What does it look like to work with the solar industry to make a thinner solar mat that is a brighter albedo and thereby does not cause as much heating at the surface while still providing solar energy? So we look at each one of these as a community, and that's really a big part of it, is like if you're in an HOA or if you're in a cul-de-sac of any form, really, and you were to say, I would like for all of the community to be able to be good for, you know, a week. What does it look like? You know, how much energy does each house need? Most people have no idea how much energy they need. So they don't know what kind of generator to buy. Do they even need a generator?
Yeah.
Can they plug their HVAC directly into the generator? Do they even have a cord long enough? Do they know how to access their HVAC? There's a lot of 101 stuff that's missing.
Yep.
When you buy a home, it doesn't come with an instruction guide like this to be able to say. So some utilities could start to work with their customers to say, hey, you know, the weather is getting worse. I've seen a lot of advocation over the last year of notifications, storms coming in, prepare, prepare, prepare.
Mm-hmm.
Where's the blue sky engagement from some of these utilities to be able to go to the community and say, we're doing our best, you know, we're burying power lines, we're doing this, we're doing that. We would like to see from you X, Y, and Z.
Right.
You know, how can we meet in the middle, knowing that some of these insurance companies aren't necessarily doing that? Maybe utilities can help to fill that gap because they're the ones going in the news, getting sued, getting all of these negative, you know, publicity from the event. They could kind of help to advocate and educate, since they have that direct customer line. They know who's on their system. They know where they live. They can send out, you know, mail. They can go to their door. There's all of these missed opportunities, I think, for communication.
Wow. Okay. All right. Well, listen, the last question, Sunny, that I ask everybody that comes on the podcast is for a book recommendation. And we put them all together in what we call the Flux Capacitor Book Club. So what book are you going to add to our reading list today?
So I'm finishing right now The Secret World of Weather. I have a bunch of physics books that, you know, they're all over the place. But The Secret World of Weather by Tristan Gooley is a really good book in understanding some of the nuances of weather. So it teaches you why one side of the hill is cooler or more windy than the other side of the hill, why being under a tree on one side yields a different microclimate feeling than the other side, why planting trees in one area yields X in another area. It gives this general comprehension to living in the environment, let alone, you know, climate and the changes that are coming, but it'll help you pay attention more to your surroundings. The more attuned you are with the changes as they're coming in, the less shocked you're going to be when you hear on the news, you know, this devastating heat wave is coming. You're going to be able to start to look for the signs, the symptoms. You're going to understand when a storm is coming in. You're going to understand what types of clouds you're seeing outside, what those are indicators of. They have, you know, fantastic graphics throughout the book to be able to sort of showcase to people what are our different types of clouds. You can play the game with your kids. It's written at a very easy to enjoy level. It's not written at a, you know, technical side. It's not written below it like a child side. It's this beautiful in between of both storytelling and, you know, visual comprehension. Oh, that I have seen that. I have felt that. And it's really good at doing it.
Fabulous. Okay. So the book recommendation today is The Secret, I found it here, The Secret World of Weather, How to Read Signs in Every Cloud, Breeze, Hill, Street, Plant, Animal, and Dewdrop by Tristan Gooley.
It is a good read.
All right. Well, that is a fabulous recommendation. We will add it to the reading list. And I want to thank you, Sunny, for taking the time to chat about the weather. You know, when people ask about how the weather is, you always have a very interesting answer.
I love to inform, and then I also enjoy being informed.
Great. Thanks for joining the podcast. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
For those that have been with the podcast since the beginning and those that have joined along the way, thanks for listening. Tune in for future episodes. Please take the time to rate the podcast on whatever platform you use to listen, and let me know what you think of the Flux Capacitor. You can find me on our website at Electricity Canada, on LinkedIn, and on Instagram as The Brad Bradley. The website for this pod is thefluxcapacitor.ca, and it includes links for this episode on the show page, this being episode 106. And while you're there, check out the book club page, which provides info on and links to the books which have been recommended by guests on the Flux Capacitor, including Sunny's recommendation, The Secret World of Weather, How to Read Signs in Every Cloud, Breeze, Hill, Street, Plant, Animal, and Dewdrop by Tristan Gooley. And let's continue the electricity conversation on our Facebook page, on Instagram, and at electricity.ca.